The legislative commission on metropolitan government meeting will begin. We have a quorum.
Oh, okay.
And we are here to hear the budget, the unified budget and program from the council. And we have Judge Chetman that's going to open the meeting. Ms. Mary Bogie, who is going to present the presentation.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Again, my name is Judd Shetland. I'm the council's government affairs director. Appreciate the opportunity to be here this morning, or I guess this afternoon. And as you know, the Legislative Commission on Metropolitan Government, what it says in there is the council should bring our unified operating and capital budgets before the commission for your review prior to the council adopting them. And a couple weeks ago, we had this meeting set up, and for whatever reason, it was postponed. So, Mr. Chair, I appreciate the opportunity to be here before the council adopts the formal budget next week. But with me, I've got Mary Bogie, who is our Chief Financial Officer at the Met Council, and she'll be able to walk through this with you. But just so I don't know if you folks know, but I did send everyone on the commission a copy of the budget a few weeks ago. I sent an electronic version, and I also brought copies today just in case you needed one to reference. But I'm here, Mary's here, and we have a number of our division directors here that will be able to speak to any questions that you might have as well. So with that, I'll turn it over to Ms. Bogie, if you're okay with that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Judge. Ms. Bogie, please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, my name is Mary Bogie, and I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the Metropolitan Council. So I thought we'd get started today by talking a little bit about our statutory responsibilities, and there's three primary areas that the Council is responsible for, and that's planning, operations, and grant making. In the planning area, we have our long-range comprehensive planning, the regional transportation planning, and regional parks. Operations, our core functions, our wastewater system, the regional transit system, and the Metro HRA. And in grant making, the Livable Community Act gives us some grant making, as well as regional parks and trails. Starting out, just kind of looking at some metrics for the council, and this particular metric chart shows regional parks visits. Our regional parks system, open year-round, receives more than 47 million visits annually, many more millions than the Mall of America by comparison. The light green highlights on the map represent 52 parks and park reserves, 7 special recreational features, and 55,000 acres of open park space. In addition, the system has 38 regional trails and over 340 miles currently open to the public. The parks are operated by 10 partnering cities, counties, and special districts, what we refer to as the parks implementing agencies. The council allocates funding to the regional parks implementing agencies for ongoing acquisition and development of the park system. The funding comes from regional bonds, state bonds, monies from the Minnesota Environmental Trust Fund, and land and legacy fund monies. The map shows the breakdown of funding by park implementing agency, and the council uses a matching of council bonds with state bonds in funding those. In addition to the amounts listed here, the Parks Acquisition Opportunity Fund grants are also intended to help the regional park agencies acquire land within their areas. These grants fund up to 75% of the acquisition costs, and the parks agencies then are required to finance 25% of those. The State General Fund also contributes to the operating costs of the 10 park implementing agencies. In 2013, that was about $8.5 million, and that covers about 9% of their costs. Metric, and that's clean water, and our wastewater treatment, as I said, is one of our core functions. Day in and day out, our wastewater system, which includes about 600 miles of sewer pipes, collects and treats 250 million gallons of wastewater. We provide wastewater collection and treatment service for approximately 2.7 million residents in 107 communities within the seven-county metro area. Getting that wastewater to the plants and processing it uses a massive amount of energy, approximately $15 million of energy per year. Since 2006, Environmental Services has reduced its energy usage by 20%. That's about $4 million a year. And they have a goal by 2020 of reducing it by 50%, and they're well on their way to doing that. Our treatment plants also operate with near-perfect permit compliance. Six of our treatment plants have received from the National Association of Clean Water Agencies the Platinum Peak Performance, which means they've met compliance for 5 years in a row. And our Hastings plant has 23 years of perfect compliance. While maintaining our high performance standards, our wastewater rates remain competitive.
And Mr. Chair, just to jump in, just a couple weeks ago, we had the Legislative Energy Commission out to our Blue Lake plant and kind of walked through some of this with them. And I know Senator Pratt was able to join us that day. And really, our wastewater enterprise really is a different type of function that people don't really see as a function of the council that often. So we really like to promote and make sure people understand kind of the financing and the role that we play in the regional wastewater system as well.
Thank you.
Thank you. This metric chart shows the history of our metro wastewater increases at an average of about 4% per year compared to national averages. The National Clean Water Agency continues to project that national averages will increase by about 5% over the next several years. That's well ahead of the consumer price index of about 1.5%. Wastewater facilities nationwide are under a lot of cost pressure, and this is primarily due to aging infrastructure, to increased regulations, and to declining technical support.
We have a question from Senator Small.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do have a question related to a couple of the spills that happened. And it's related to INI possibly, but it was the Metro Interceptor lines that were released. One was released in North St. Paul, and all that sewage, raw sewage, went from Forest Lake all the way down through the Phelan chain of lakes, eventually into Phelan and into Mississippi River, and then the one over in Minnetonka as well. Have you done any long-range planning for maybe a holding pond for spills, or because they occur in certain areas, or something to that effect? Or is the Met Council looking at anything in that regard?
Mr. Chair and Senator Scalzi, we are aware of the INI issue, and for folks who might not know, it's called inflow and infiltration, and that's where we've got water that is coming from the wastewater system that then somehow gets out of the system. A lot of times it's because of cracks in the infrastructure. It's old infrastructure. The council is responsible for the regional interceptor pipes that collect these the flow, I guess is a nice way to put it. But there are service laterals that folks who have a private home or you own a business that the private homeowner actually owns. And then there are municipal pipes that they flow into the municipal pipes and then they get to the council. And so we do have a variety of ways that we're trying to address INI. As folks may know, that we have received state general obligation bonding funds for that in the past. And we've done that obviously through the state. The issue with the state is that since they are public bonds, they can only be provided to municipalities or another public entity. And so what we have attempted to do, and we were successful in this in 2013, is to receive legacy funds, then that we're setting up grant programs that allow us to pass that along to private homeowners to actually fix their service laterals. And there are a number of folks who don't even know that they own that pipe. And we're estimating that 60 to 70% of the inflow and infiltration that is occurring, where those issues are occurring, are at the private homeowner, private business level. And so what we are doing is we've got a proposal that we are bringing forward to the governor for him to consider about whether or not we are able to bring that to the legislature. That really deals with getting a sound idea of what the INI issue is regionally. Because what we don't want to do is to fix the system at the Met Council level or maybe even the municipal level if the INI problem is occurring more at the local private level. Because otherwise, we're just building bigger pipes to clean water that is getting into our system. He had the situation at his home and was able to use one of those grants in order to fix his service lateral. And so we are preparing our budget right now and are looking at a couple of budget items and then policy items related to INI. And we are as concerned about the INI problem as everyone else, and when these spills occur, it's a terrible, terrible situation. And so we're trying to get a handle on what is the true regional impact of INI. And I guess answer any other questions that you have, other than the fact that we are looking at doing something with that right now.
Senator Scalzi has a follow-up.
I understand, what we're trying to do with the INI long-term. My concern is for the short-term,
yep,
when these pipes are opened, because otherwise they would come up in people's homes. So the pipes are opened. We don't have a lagoon or any other type of system, because I know the long-term, we're talking 20, 30 years to get those corrected.
Yeah.
But the short-term is any time we have a heavy rainfall, and we're not addressing that situation.
Short-term.
And we could, with a lagoon system or some type of extraneous piping system, rather than sullying up the lakes that we're putting clean water money into to clean up. So that's what I'm getting at.
Yep,
immediate here.
Yep, Mr. Chair and Senator Scalzi, I think it's worthwhile for you and I and maybe the PCA, who really handles the permitting around when that flow is released, when that occurs, and maybe talk about some of the short-term ideas, because you're correct. I mean, we could have a terrible flood situation again where we're right back into that same situation. And so that's why we at the council are trying to look at it long-term and short-term, but the idea of setting up these ponds or whatever we want to call them is something that that maybe we should have that conversation about before session starts.
Mm-hmm. Representative Freiberg has a question.
Thank you. I'm glad you brought up the issue of the legacy grants, Mr. Shetland. That's certainly something I supported. I was on the legacy committee. I know those funds weren't nearly enough to address the overall issue throughout the metropolitan region. I know you mentioned that I got one of the grants. I was lucky enough to do that, but I know that about a month, if I'd waited about a month longer, there wouldn't have been any funds available. And I asked this question at our last hearing, which was in September, I think, but you mentioned you're still trying to figure out what the impact around the region is financially. If we were to, I know it was quite a large sum, probably more than we would be able to handle, but just so we have a sense of the scope of the problem, do you have an estimate of what it would cost for a fund that would be sufficient to address that throughout the metro area that wouldn't run out?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I have an estimate, but it is it's very large. I would say probably, I mean, I'm not even sure if we want to put a number on it yet. That's part of what the analysis that we're trying to potentially bring forward with policy next year to identify that. But you're talking in the tens of millions of dollars range, and on the probably the higher end of that. That's why this is so important, because if we can fix it at the point, it's a heck of a lot cheaper than having to build all new interceptor pipes which for all we know are able to satisfy and carry the amount of flow that's coming through there when the choke point is occurring, when the pipes leading to our interceptors are being backed up, and that's when you see the backups occur into the homes, and that's when we have to open up to let it all out so we don't have the backups occur in the homes. And it really is a serious issue that that I think we need to discuss.
Follow up.
Yeah. Just more of a comment than a question. I guess I should mention too, for so people know what this involves. The grant that I received only covered about a third of the cost. I was still responsible for a couple thousand dollars out of the cost. And I know there are people certainly in my community and in other ones who have more expensive repair projects than that. And I know they can get up to the neighborhood of $10,000. But I do think it's an important first step. I mean, you mentioned that a lot of people don't know that they own the sewers, and I think that's true. And I think, unfortunately, too, a lot of people don't know that this grant program exists. So I think publicizing it, I think, is something we need to look at during this session, too, if we are going to continue with it, as I hope we do.
And, Mr. Chair, just one last point. When we talk about I&I, it is a regional problem. We have I&I issues across the entire metro area. So it's not just the fact that you're next to Lake Minnetonka or by White Bear Lake. There are I&I issues all over the place. West St. Paul, for instance, has a huge I&I problem. And so it's something that we are taking very seriously. And, you know, Senator, I keep wanting to call you Representative, Senator Scalzi, you know, I think that it'd probably be a good idea for us to have that conversation, because it's only going to, you know, rise up again when the rain comes.
Mr. Shetton, for historical purposes, and so we're all on the same page, could you give us just a brief description of the two instances that that Senator Scalzi has brought up, with the timing and then also what happened? And I think we intentionally opened up the flow to, for instance, Lake Minnetonka.
Yep.
And what happened after that?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm not the PCA scientist that handles this, but I will give you my kind of off-the-cuff understanding of what occurred. Is that then when the PCA permitted for that outflow to occur, what ended up happening is then they had to shut down the beach around Mound for a few days, maybe a week, until the testing of the E. coli within the area of that beach was within acceptable standards of to allow for swimming. And you know, this occurred after a period of rain where we were receiving somewhere between 4 and 6 inches of rain in the at a time when the lake in the pocket was at an all time high. So the fact of the matter is there may have been pipes that were sitting there in the water just around the lake that were already filled with water. And so when this unprecedented rain came through, there was a terrible situation, and these pipes backed up, and then the pipes were opened in order to, I guess, keep the situation from getting even worse. And so we had another issue out in the Norwood Young America area where something like this happened during that same period of time. And I'm not as familiar, Senator Scalzi, as what happened in the northern metro area. But regardless of where it happened, that's kind of the way that it is dealt with. And it's not a good situation in any situation that it occurs.
And also, can you how frequently has this happened, where we've actually put raw sewage into the stormwater?
You know, if you'll allow me, I'd like to email you back on that. I don't know. I can't give you a specific answer, but I know that there were those two situations in Norwood Young America area and the Mound area that occurred right around the middle of June.
Thank you, Senator. Just a little bit more, if I could, on that issue, Mr. Shetland. So could you talk more about the St. Louis Park situation and how many homes were affected, and, you know, where the infrastructure problem occurred? And how you know that? I mean, how much investigation then was required to really determine the source of the problem?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Shin, Senator, I know I want to call you Senator Brumbeck. Senator Brumbeck, you guys are getting me confused here.
We have switched.
Yep. I'm not sure what happened at St. Louis Park. What I was referring to was in the Mound area, yeah, really. Mound, West Tonka, Minnetonka area. And I don't have it with me today, but we spent some quality time with Senator Osmick to kind of show the analysis of where the flow was coming from at peak period of times, because we have monitors that we have on each of the interceptors and the pumps that we use. And so I can't speak to it with, I guess, to the finite detail that you're looking for today, but I can certainly sit down and show you how we were able to see where the flow was coming from and where the issue occurred that led to having to open up those pipes.
Freiburg, was it a whole neighborhood then that was affected in your situation?
In our case, Chair, Representative Runbeck, in our case, the city of Golden Valley had quite a bit of issues. We have poor soils, and so it's a little more acute, I think, in our part of the metro than in other areas. I'm just trying to think of the background. We have a point of sale program in Golden Valley where whoever sells their house has to get the sewer inspected by a city inspector. They come in with a video camera, look for any holes in the sewer and tell you where the problems are. Most, well over a majority of the sewers are not compliant with it when they sell, and mine certainly wasn't. So, just in anticipation of that, you know, the possibility that we might sell our house at some point, we knew this, my wife and I knew this grant funding was available, so we applied for it and got it fixed. So, I know the program is available throughout the metro area. Yep. Anyone can take advantage of it if they have a sewer problem. Mm-hmm. Just because we have this point of sale program in place in the city of Golden Valley, I suspect it's maybe being taken advantage of more mm-hmm. there than in other communities.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck, a lot of times what we find is in these older neighborhoods where the service laterals are potentially clay pipe or else where there are tree roots that are getting in there and working their way through that pipe. And as they grow, they make the holes bigger and bigger and bigger. And so it's more mature neighborhoods that we are finding some of the INI issues, but it is region-wide, and it does occur not just necessarily in the older communities, but there are just issues with INI everywhere. Mm-hmm. And so I would love to come back and have our environmental services staff who deal with this maybe go into the real detail regarding what this is. Because we're missing an O in there, because it's inflow and infiltration, and there's also outflow that occurs, and that's really nasty.
Mr. Shetland, I think that would be a good idea, because that's affecting a lot of communities.
Yep.
And I know that in my community in Eagan, we were under the microscope to look for the INI house by house.
Yep.
And I believe the inspections of most of the homes has been done.
Yep.
And I don't know that we've come through with a totally clean bill of health, but at least in the newer neighborhoods, that hasn't been a problem. And there's been, been some findings of, for instance, some pumps being connected.
Yep.
Not rain gutters, but sometimes stormwater is getting into the sewage system.
Yep. Well, and Mr. Chair, one other impact of INI is that, the state has put such forth a huge effort into protecting clean water. And so what happens is that when we are taking water, clean water that's getting into our sewer system, what we do, there's a cost to the system to clean this clean water. And then what we do is pump it into the river, and it goes down to New Orleans. And so what we're trying to do is to try to find a way to protect that natural resource. And so I actually am really encouraged by the conversation that we're having here. And I do think that we could spend some quality time amongst this group just to talk about the issue and some of the potential, programs that we could put in place. I know what Representative Freiberg is referring to is something that we are kind of interested in as well. I know the city of Eden Prairie and the city of Eagan both have that point of sale situation there that the cities are requiring. I also know that Metro Cities, our friends at Metro Cities, are also very interested in inflow and infiltration as well. So we could have a much broader conversation about this.
And as of anything, it comes down that there's going to be a cost.
Yeah.
Which brings us back to Mary Bogie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We will continue on with our discussion. Much like the nation, the council is facing as well those challenges for aging infrastructure and for increasing regulations. Our debt service is increasing by about 5% a year and inflation about 3% a year in our budgets. For 2015, the council adopted a 3.5% increase in the metro wastewater charge. Compared to similarly sized utilities across the country, our wastewater service charge at about $21 a month is approximately 40% lower than the national average. That shows a little bit better on this chart. This metric chart shows the regional cost of water index for the calendar year 2013. Thank you. The national average amount a single family residence pays for wastewater treatment in 2013 was $435 per year. In our region, that was $407 per year. In 2014, the national average increased to $457. By comparison, residents of the Twin Cities metro area on average paid $255 in 2014. This amount includes both the council charges as well as local charges. In addition to treating wastewater, the clean water metric also applies to the council, and we've done a lot of work with the Clean Water Legacy Fund and in partnership with the agencies that you see up there in developing a roadmap that's really set some ambitious but achievable goals around lake water quality, river and stream water quality, groundwater quality, and groundwater quantity. And so that is becoming a bigger part of the council as well in focusing on that unclean water. Our next metric area is housing, and the Metro HRA administers the largest Section 8 housing choice voucher program in the state of Minnesota. The program provides housing for over 6,500 households and does so in a very efficient way. In fact, HUD has again ranked the council with its highest possible rating for efficiency and effective housing services. Our Section 8 program uses the existing private rental market and provides payments to private landlords on the behalf of low-income renters. Participating property owners are guaranteed a stable income, and families may rent any type of housing in the Metro HRA area, yellow on the map for the Metro HRA, from participating landowners there. The eligible households pay about 30 to 40% of their incomes for rent, and the Metro HRA then picks up the difference.
We have a question from Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious, this is maybe a little off topic, but under what circumstances does someone lose their Section 8 benefit? I know it's, I'll just let you answer that question. I know some of the reasons, but.
Mr. Chair, income would be one of the reasons that their income raised, their household number. So there's a number of factors that would go into that. I am not familiar with all of them, but we could certainly send something out related to that.
Just wondered, Mr. Chair,
if
Mr. Shetland might know the answer to that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, that's about as good as I know as well.
Okay.
But I can send an email to the commission here to follow up on what the rules are for getting in and how you get out. of the program as well. But I do think that income and is a big factor in that.
Household size.
And household size. I know that there have to be some sort of regulations, but the HRA, most of that is funded through federal funds as well. So there are federal guidelines that we have to meet. So I'm not quite as familiar with that versus the state guidelines.
No worries.
We'll continue on, and next metric looks at our Louisville Communities Grant Programs. The council awards grants to cities, counties, and their development authorities for Livable Communities Program. These grants are funded by property tax and help clean up polluted sites for redevelopment, expand affordable housing opportunities, and build pedestrian-friendly and transit-oriented developments. This program is voluntary, it's incentive-based approach, and it helps communities grow and redevelop and address the region's affordable housing and life cycle housing. The program was established in 1995 by the Livable Community Act, and since 1996, the council has awarded 787 grants totaling more than $270 million through the Livable Communities Funds. These grants leverage billions of dollars, as you can see on the graphic here, in both private and other public funds.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Brennan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I wondered, is it possible to get any kind of a breakdown for the Livable Communities grants in terms of the type of housing, what percent multifamily, what percent single family, what areas these are, what cities these are occurring in?
Mr. Chair, we can certainly provide that.
Yep.
Great, thank you.
Yep, and Mr. Chair, I'm just going to jump in real quick as well, is that one thing that the council does and I lead is that prior to session, I send all members a copy of the different services within their districts that the council plays a role in, between your transit, metro mobility, regional dial-a-ride, your investment in parks, housing, Section 8 housing vouchers, the livable communities investments. So we can provide you what you're looking for in total, but you'll also be receiving from me within the next few weeks a breakdown of each of those within either your House district or your Senate district. So if you have particular questions about what's going on in your district, we will have that for you shortly.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, I was, Mr. Shetland, more interested in a big picture.
Yep, and we'll, Mr. Chair, Representative Runback, we'll get that for you. Okay. We'll just do it for each of these accounts.
Great, okay.
Thank you, that's good.
Okay, moving on, we'll move to our metrics related to ridership. And regional transit provides 260,000 rides daily, more than 94 million rides in 2013. As you can see by the graphic, the bus system accounts for a large portion of that, both the urban, local, and express bus, as well as suburban transit providers. The bus system accounts for 85% of our regional riders. Just to look at the regional transit providers, including both the Metropolitan Council, Metro Transit for the bus regular route, Blue Line and Green Line light rail, commuter rail, Metro Transit Services, Metro Mobility, Contracted Services, Transit Link, and then the suburban transit providers, Maple Grove, MVTA, Plymouth, Prior Lake, Shakopee, and Southwest Transit. So those are the regional providers of transit. And looking at our metric here, we can see, as I said, for 2013, 94 million rides. Metro Transit Bus and Rail provided the largest portion of those rides, about 86% or 80 million rides. Suburban transit providers provided about 5.5% or 5.2 million rides, and other council transit programs then account for the difference, Metro Mobility, Transit Link.
Ms. Bogan, Mr. Shetton, I've seen some discussion in the media recently about the count of rides for those, for light rail, for instance, where you buy your ticket and then are supposed to have it on your person. How do you count those? Are those tickets sold? Or are those people entering and exiting?
Mr. Chair, I know Mr. Brian Lamb is here, but I'm going to try to answer this real briefly. We have automated passenger counters on the light rail trains that as you walk across into the train, there's actually a counter there that you don't see that is counting your ride as you come through there. And so that is one way that we're able to identify rides, because as you know, we have different types of fares that people use, and so we feel like we get a better idea of the actual ridership, because not everybody's always scanning their ticket if they carry a pass that shows that they have that that fare on their person. And so having the automated passenger counters really does then allow for us to get that, because as you come through and get off, they're able to count that as a passenger.
All right.
And I hope I have that right. Close enough.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Our 2015 budget anticipates ridership greater than 100 million rides. Continuing on with our metric for ridership, this slide shows that 80% of our riderships are going to work and school, and we have a number of fare media that is oriented towards those types of riders. So our Metro Pass has 275 participating employers and provides about 12.12 million rides. College Pass and UPass, for College Pass, 50 participating colleges, about 3 million rides. UPass, about 4.8 million rides. Finally, we have Student Pass as well, and this is for some of our high school students participating, about 39 schools participating, and 2.9 million rides. This next metric is specifically looking at the Metro Green Line average weekday ridership. In our budget for year one for the Green Line, we anticipated 27,500 rides, and we are averaging ridership in the 30s. And in fact, our weekday ridership for 2013 was projected at 40,940. And as you can see by our ridership numbers, we are very close to hitting that already. A little bit of a dip that you see in November. As I said, most of our riders are going to work and school, and we have a Thanksgiving holiday in November, and therefore they were spending time at home with their families. So really great performance on the Green Line.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Fernbeck.
Thank you. This, I think, is, I had asked this question earlier. So there was an express line that carried 15,000 folks to the downtown, their commutes. And I'm just wondering if this number then reflects the net number. I mean, because, you know, they lost their way of, their means of transportation, my understanding, anyway. So,
Mr. Chair, maybe I'll let Mr. Lamb come speak to that, because there are different types of service that we've got a 94 Express, and then we've got the different routes that go along.
So that number is going to be showing somewhere else?
I'll let Mr. Lamb speak to that.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Brian Lamb. I'm General Manager for Metro Transit. Related to the specific question, we have done, I think the last time we met with the commission, we talked a little bit that we're still doing the analysis on all of the corridor routes. Since that time, we've completed our first couple of months analysis, and we look at growth in the corridor routes when you take the bus ridership and the Green Line ridership of more than 20% growth compared to similar time last year. So the Route 16, which was kind of the workhorse local route, averaged about 14,000, 15,000 rides per day prior to the Green Line opening, and now averages about 3,000 rides per day. The Route 50, which was kind of the limited stop service along University Avenue, went away in its entirety, and that was kind of a net drop of about 4,000 rides per day. The 94, which is the express route connecting downtown Minneapolis to downtown St. Paul, that still has peak hour service, very frequent peak hour service, about 10-minute frequency, but has about half an hour off-peak service and no weekend service, compared to about 15-minute off-peak service and about 30-minute weekend service previous to the Green Line. So the daily ridership on the 94 is down about 40% from where it was, but still represents about 4,000 rides per day. As I said, the net impact of the implementation of the Green Line, the reduction of the service in the bus line, is about a net 20% gain in ridership along that corridor.
Okay, and Mr. Chairman, then this 27,000, or which is the right number? 27 represents the corridor totals right now?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the 27,000 was what was projected for after the first year of full operation for the Green Line itself, mm-hmm. not for the NEC corridor.
Okay.
And similarly, the numbers that you see on the monthly total mm-hmm. above the 38,600 for October, for example, that's the Green Line itself on an average day.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, then, so the corridor, I mean, I don't know what's more important. It sounds to me like corridor might be, but so that those numbers are available if we'd like to see the corridor numbers?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, Lamb. They are.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Mr. Lamb, what's the capacity of that the express bus service that's going unused, for instance? Are we getting, you said that there's a drop of 40%? And what is the ultimate capacity? Is it a full trip?
Mr. Chair, as a regular user of that, I can tell you during the rush hours, these are full articulated buses, the 60-foot buses, sometimes standing loads. So we are very pleased with the productivity of the remaining service that's still on Route 94 during the rush hours especially. The reduction in the overall count is because we no longer have weekend service available on the 94, and then the off-peak, the evenings and the middle of the day, that frequency is reduced. But the productivity per trip is still very high.
Senator Dibble.
And just so we have thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a frame of reference, an articulated bus seated capacity is what, about 60 people?
Mr. Chair, Senator, your memory is very good. All 62 right. people, right. depending on the bus.
All right, thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Lamb. Ms. Boogie.
Mr. Chair, this next metric chart is a little bit dated. In fact, it's the same chart that I showed you last year. But it's a good indicator of the variation between the performance of our different services offered. So the light rail system is the lowest subsidy, and the dial-a-ride, which is a door-to-door service, you can see is the highest or most expensive service to run. In 2013, across our service types for Metro Transit only, our recovery was 27%, and if we just looked at Metro Transit, Bus Express, and Local, it was about 31%. We compiled this data every couple of years for the region as a total, and we should have our 2013 numbers pretty soon. So finally, we're going to take a look at now, we've looked at our metrics and what kinds of services the council provides, and we'll take a look at the cost of those services. So the council adopts an annual operating and capital budget, including a six-year capital plan, and we're going to start by looking at our operating budget. Our operating budget for 2015 is proposed to be $928 million. This chart shows how it breaks out between operations. Our pass-through programs, those are our grant and loan programs, and as well as money passing through to the suburban transit providers, and debt service. The $928 million budget is about a 4% increase over the 2014 budget. Pressures from debt service, as well as growing operations, a full year of the Green Line operations, increasing demand for Metro Mobility services are the primary drivers of that increase. This next pie chart shows how the budget breaks out between divisions, and you can see Transportation Division is 60% of our budget, Environmental Services 20%, Community Development Program is about 12%. Regional Administration is allocated out to the, in the most part, to the other divisions, so we see their costs within those divisions.
Ms. Bogey, would it be possible to get a breakdown of how that increase is broken up? You mentioned it, but can we get a breakdown of that,
We certainly can.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative
quick question on the operating budget transportation. So Green Line represents a new added cost for this year. How much was that? And what do you anticipate Southwest Light Rail would add when it comes on board?
Mr. Chair and members, adding the Green Line full year service, about $5.5 million added to the budget between 2014 and 2015. I don't have an estimate handy with me today related to the Southwest Light Rail line operations. That's something that we could provide.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, and Representative Rumbach, it's important to remember on the transitways that the council share is a portion of the operating subsidy. Part of it comes from fares. The other part of it comes from our partners at CTIP.
Nearly 60% of our operations slice of the budget is related to salaries, and that's reflected in our staffing complement. The majority of the complement in transportation represents our bus and rail operators that are directly putting service on the street. This next slide shows the sources of funding for our proposed operating budget. Charges for services make up the largest portion. That includes fares and wastewater fees. The state revenues that you see in the green slice are primarily motor vehicle sales tax revenues, but also include general fund appropriations for transit, parks, and a small amount for I&I grants. Federal revenues primarily support our HRA and also some transit operations. I'll talk about property taxes in a moment, but about 9% of our budget is supported by property taxes. Use of reserves is a function of our regional allocation policy. So for our motor vehicle sales tax and the way we allocate that among the regional transit providers, we first draw down reserves and then put in motor vehicle sales tax revenues to meet their operating needs. So the next slide is our property tax levy, and the council proposed a 0.5% increase to its property tax levy. So our property tax levy is $80 million. Property taxes are primarily used to pay debt service on bonds that support our capital programs for parks and transit. Represented by the green shaded areas on the pie chart, debt service is about 62% of our levy. The Livable Communities grant programs are represented by the blue shaded areas. They are the next biggest slice of the pie. And then our general purposes levy is the red area, and that funds about 2% of our operating budget.
Sure. Senator Dibble, question.
Thank you. Just had a question on the levy and the annual increase to the levy that's usually been around either 1%, or now it looks like you're looking at 0.5%. Is there any practical limitation on the amount the levy can be increased?
Mr. Chair.
Literal or practical? Mm-hmm. What are the limitations under which you operate or make that decision?
Ms. Bogey.
Mr. Chair, there are limitations on our levy as they relate to the general purposes and livable communities. They can increase by the implicit price deflator each year, so that's about a little over 1%. Our debt service levies are not limited per se in the amount we can levy for debt service, but they are limited by the amount of debt that we are allowed to issue, and therefore stay kind of right around that range.
Thank you.
And I'd like to add just real quickly, Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, is that I think most folks know, but the tax-based revitalization funds comes off of the fiscal disparities account. So that comes off the top of that account every year. I don't know if people are aware of that or not.
Senator Dibble.
So the implicit price deflator limitation, is that a function of statute or Met Council policy?
Mr.
Ms. Bogey.
It is in statute.
Okay, thank you.
this next slide kind of gets to your point as well, as do we set a standard around where the council's levy is, and I would say that the council has been very good over its history of holding the impact of our levy on the taxpayer as low as possible. And if we look at the inflation rate over the last 10 years versus the council levy, you can see that the council has been very good at limiting that taxpayer impact. As you know, the metropolitan area taxes are split among several governmental entities. As this graphic shows, counties, cities, and school districts are by far the largest portion of the metro tax dollar. The council typically receives about 2% of the revenue collected from property taxes paid by metro area residents. This next chart.
Senator Dibble, question.
Still mulling some questions over. The debt that is supported by the property tax levy, that's transit capital debt, correct? That's levied against a subset of the metropolitan area. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator, that is correct. And I'll talk about that a little bit on this next slide. The transit debt service and the parks debt service are supporting the capital program for transit and debt. The transit levy is only levied on those residents inside the metro transit taxing communities, whereas the parks levy is on the region.
And the Mr. Chair,
Senator Dibble.
The wastewater debt is supported by wastewater revenue, correct?
Mr. Chair and Senator, by wastewater fees and SAC charges.
Thank you.
Availability charges. So, Mr. Chair, this chart estimates the impact to the taxpayer residing both inside and outside of the transit taxing communities. About 88% of the net tax capacity, by the way, is within the transit taxing communities. So this is kind of an all things equal being approach. So my house was worth $250,000 last year, as was my neighbor's house held their value, my community held their value. So all things being equal, the impact of the change in the council's levy is about 46 cents outside the transit taxing communities, and within the transit taxing communities about 29 cents. Chair, I'll move on to the council's capital program. The council's capital program includes both authorized and planned projects. As I said, our capital improvement plan is a six-year plan, and it's just that. It's a plan of projects over the next 6 years. Planned projects are based on anticipated revenues and are amended by a budget amendment to the authorized program only when those funds have been secured. Our authorized capital program, about $4 billion, that is a little bit misleading because our authorized capital program contains projects and they stay in the authorized program until they are closed out. So the final report is written, the project is complete, and therefore about two-thirds of our capital program, the authorized capital program, has already been spent in prior years because it's a multi-year program. So in particular, as you'll see in these charts, transitways make up a large part of both our authorized capital program and our CIP. But I think it's really important for us, as those are definitely expansion programs, but if we were to take out those and look at our capital program with the exception of those new rail starts, about 74% or three-quarters of our capital program is focused on preservation. So preservation means fleet and infrastructure preservation. We do have some expansion projects in the CIP. Expansion projects include parks land acquisition, increased capacity of our wastewater collection, and some new BRT service. Improvement projects in our CIP improve quality and operating efficiency, and good examples of those are those energy projects as we were talking about in the wastewater system. Okay. This next pie chart shows how we fund the capital program. And just a reminder, again, that funding sources in the capital program are not always secured, and we don't move things into the authorized program, thereby allowing them to be spent until those funds have been secured. So as we look at this chart, we can see that federal revenues are the majority of the sources for the capital program, followed by our own council GO bonds. CTIB is a major funder of our transit capital program. The state GO bonds are in that, as well as some other locals. We do have a small pay-as-you-go program in our wastewater that is growing a little bit, and that's one of our ways of getting a handle on that increasing debt service. And finally, Mr. Chair, my last slide shows the outstanding general obligation debt for the council as of the end of the year at $1.5 billion. I will say that the council is a AAA rated agency from both Moody's and Standard & Poor's. In our general obligation debt, you can see that wastewater is the big player in our outstanding bonds, and that's exactly for the reason that we just talked about a minute ago, and is that wastewater fees and SAC charges are what fund the wastewater system, and therefore we issue bonds to that are paid off with those sources. Transit and parks have other funding sources as well as our bonds. We use our bonds mostly to match other funds and meet the cash flow of the capital program. And Mr. Chair, that's the end of our presentation.
I have one question. You mentioned that these projects stay in until closed. Are there projects that are where there's unspent monies that will be turned back? What's the state of that?
Mr. Chair, there are not projects in there where there are unspent funds. That won't be spent. As we each year take a look at our budget, we are looking at that all the time, and we will repurpose those funds. Once we know that the project is done with the spend it, we repurpose those funds to other projects in the CIP.
Other authorized projects? Mm-hmm. So they're not. It's not a matter of a pot of money, and you find something to spend it on.
Right.
Definitely not.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
A question from Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the wastewater, so the projects, $1.2 billion. Can you just name some that are going on around the Twin Cities? I mean, they're so subsurface. You never even know, I guess, that these are happening. But what identify
one that I know of. If you lived in my part of town, you would know, because it's above surface. We have major work going on, and it's very much above surface until they get below surface. So it just depends on what they're doing exactly. Sometimes you really know. It's really disruptive.
Well, Mr.
But we're coming to the end of it, and I'm really happy about
that.
Yeah. Okay.
We all are.
Well, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Shetland, do they have names? I mean, how do you identify them? What are some?
Mr. Chair, no. I would also point you to the budget book, and in the appendix there is a list of the capital projects going on.
Okay.
So let me look for environmental services here.
I can do it real quick. I see it here. Just looking on page G11, there are the interceptor in the Wayzata area. We've got an interceptor in Chaska, interceptor in Hopkins, lift station rehab, meter improvements, the Golden Valley improvement area, Lake Elmo. I mean, these are region-wide that there is being that investment to maintain this critical system that is occurring across the region that, again, this system has been in the ground for years that we are continually having to maintain and preserve and improve. And so that is where that investment is going. And like Senator Dibble mentioned, we do have other big projects, like one in the Sidna neighborhood in Minneapolis, that you see because we are having to put pipes above ground while we fix the pipes that are below ground. But that isn't always the case. And if you would like a specific list of what we have going on, I can certainly do that. But it's included here in the budget pages. They don't get the attention that our transitways do.
Well, Mr. Chair, and you're so right. And I'm just, curious. MnDOT, makes a very specific, assessment inventory of insufficient, inadequate bridges, for example, and now we know that maybe 70% of them have been repaired. Yeah. Do you look at that within your system?
You know, Mr. Chair, Representative Rumbeck, we do. And we do that analysis on a continual basis because nobody thinks about the wastewater system until it doesn't work. And so we do that. And I can't offer you anything more specific than that other than to come have our environmental services folks sit down and kind of explain to you how we do that. And I'm happy to do that if that would be something you'd like. But what we're showing you in our capital budget here is exactly of how that money is being planned for and how, when we have the money, how it's being spent.
All right. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Senator Pratt, question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. How much has Thrive 2040 and specifically the transportation policy plan affected the budget? How might we assess the impacts of the of those two docs?
Mr. Chair,
Ms. Bogie.
Definitely Thrive 2040 is entwined within our budget and our business processes. So where will we see things? We'll see things in the criteria that we use when we're evaluating grants.
And then if projects moved up in priority, then projects moved down in priority. And is that something you can provide to the
Commission? Mr. Chair, Senator Pratt, I think yes, that could be the case, but it depends on how you apply that because we don't know what communities are going to do related to proposals that are going to submit say a livable community grant. So I can't give you something that looks into the future as to what they're going to propose. But I understand the question. I just can't provide you the answer that you're looking for. I apologize for that. But that's just the case.
The project being driven by the local communities, not necessarily by the council.
Well, they will be judged against the criteria that our advisory committees make recommendations into the council.
Okay.
And so, you know, we've got, on our advisory committees, we've got representatives from cities and counties that all participate and then make those recommendations to the council. It's just what they use in the criteria when deciding who they should recommend for the different funds. So there's a big process that goes along in that isn't just the council saying this is what it's going to be.
Mr. Chair, it would be very difficult in our budget to point to one line and say this is Thrive. Thrive is really, you know, the business processes and the priorities and that the council has told us here's our direction.
Question, Representative Rembeck. Well, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have actually several questions, but related to Thrive, One thing I didn't bring down here, I copied off all the public comments on the Thrive 2040 plan, and I got, they're all integrated, and I was going to put one stack, you know, for and one stack against. I haven't gotten that done yet, but I'm wondering, Mr. Chair, if we're going to have any opportunity for our group here to meet and discuss that plan and discuss the public comments. And I know many of the counties and cities were very unhappy with that plan, and so I'm just wondering if you have plans in the future to hear about that.
Representative Scott, I think what you asked is exactly what we're looking for, is to get agenda items for future meetings. So yes, I think that that should be the answer, that yes, we should be talking about that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. And then to the council folks up there, I'm wondering, I know on the capital budget you've got kind of a comparison from 11, 12, you know, through the last, you know, 4 or 5 years, but on the operations I'm not seeing a comparison for year after year. Particularly, I'm interested in operations for transit and what the percentage of increase from, say, 2011 to present might be.
Yep. Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, I'm sure we can provide that. I think what you'll find is much of the growth has occurred with the Central Corridor, the staffing that occurred as we brought that online, and then also the staffing of the Southwest Corridor Project Office as well. And so, but we can provide that going back to 2011, did you say?
Mm-hmm.
And leading up to the change, we can do that.
Okay, thank you.
Happy to do it.
And Mr. Chair, I don't want to hog the microphone here, but I have a couple more questions, if that's okay, if you'll indulge me.
Sure.
Thank you.
Representative Scott.
Another question. In the Thrive plan, some of the documents allude to the council's taking on of the achievement gap, and I'm wondering what the council might be spending on that category of concern that they expressed, if there are actually, if there are actually dollars going into something at this point.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, we're shifting a little bit away from the budget at this point, and I know that that's what Mary was prepared to speak to, and I'm prepared to speak to. That's a policymaker question, most likely. And so I don't know what the answer is related to that question, but I think the right answer would be to have one of our policymakers speak to that. And Mr. Chair, maybe that's something we could add to the next meeting, or Representative Scott, something I could follow up with you on, because that's a question that I'm not the policymaker to answer that question.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, thank you.
Representative Scott.
Well, if it's listed as a priority for the council, then wouldn't you be spending money on it? So that would be a budget item.
Mr. Chair, there's nothing specifically in the budget for that item. The ways to address that, maybe, as we are seeing shortages of people with skills that we need to do electrical work on the light rail lines. One of the ways that we build and the skills to fill those positions, those hard to fill positions, might be partnering with a technical school to have a program where we can help them to help us get people into those positions. I don't think any of that is far enough along, but those are the kinds of thoughts that we would have of bridging the gaps that we have in our need to hire staff with these kinds of skills that we're not finding in the marketplace. But again, there's nothing specifically in our 2015 budget related to
Mr. Chair, yeah, I would like to take this topic up in the future, because I understand what you're saying there, but that's really not addressing the achievement gap for high school graduates and the difference between, children of color and the whole what the achievement gap really is. Mm-hmm. Yes, we do have a skills gap, for sure, that we also need to address, which is a different issue, and then I just would want to address to where the council sees that they have the authority to address something like the achievement gap. Let's see. I'll let somebody else answer or ask the questions. I think I had a couple, but I have to look.
Okay. Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Perhaps I need some some clarification. I was under the impression that Thrive 2040 is yet to be adopted by the council. And then here the questions and comments make it sound as though it's a fait accompli. Perhaps you could clarify that, either Mr. Shetnan or Ms. Bogie.
Mr. Chair, the council has adopted the Thrive 2040 plan. There are also other plans, the transportation policy plan, the housing policy plan, environment, water plan. Those plans are in the process of being developed and have not yet been adopted by the council, but the Thrive 2040 plan has been adopted.
Has been, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up then. Seems to me, I mean, it was just recently then, November, is that right? Was it, because I'm recalling some notifications.
The Thrive Plan was adopted in May. And what you're hearing, today is the discussion that's going around the transportation policy plan, the housing policy plan, the water issues that we're having, and the environmental plans that we bring forward. But the Thrive Plan was adopted almost 6 months ago,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Runbeck.
Thank you. Could you just clarify the voting process on that? I mean, does the council actually vote on that?
Yes.
Mr.
Chair, Representative Runbeck, they do.
Mr. Shetnan.
They vote as a council, and they bring this through the different committee structures that we have set up in our community development, our management committee, the transportation committees, and environment committees, and they look at this and they work together creating this policy, and then they adopt it. And it's similar to what was passed in 2004, 2003, which was called the Blueprint 2030, or the Regional Development Plan. So this is a requirement of the council to create this document and bring it forward. The name for it this year was the Thrive Plan, but it's not a new or unique document. But what comes out of that then are the systems plans and the policy plans that drive the systems plans that then lead to the comprehensive plans that the cities are required by law to submit by 2018. And so there's this long process that goes about the whole regional planning, and the Thrive is the first part of that.
Well, thank you, Mr. Quick follow-up. So this fall, then, there was some amount of outcry from cities and counties about what the plan really is going to entail going forward. And is there, you know, in your mind, some opportunity for them to, you know, have their concerns addressed, or any chance for the plan to be changed or amended?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, we went through a very large public engagement process. What you're speaking to is mostly the transportation policy plan, I believe. And I think that you're referencing it, and I think Representative Scott is referencing some of the issues that we've heard from the regional five counties outside of Hennepin and Ramsey County in relation to the transportation policy plan. And so there was engagement there. I know our chair, Hegg, participated in a meeting with them, along with Transportation Commissioner Charlie Zelli. And that since that point in time, they sent a questionnaire of about 17 questions that they were interested in the council commenting on. We have provided a response to that, and then we are also meeting individually with those counties. And I believe it was Tuesday of this week, we met with Washington County and their commissioners regarding the transportation policy plan. So all of that is still occurring, and the transportation policy plan will be adopted in late January of this year. So there is still the conversation going on. The public hearing and draft, whatever occurred, and the comment occurred, and now what is happening is the council is tightening that up to bring forward for passage later next month.
And Mr. Shetnan, you mentioned that
they've met with the Washington County Board. Are the other counties, the collar counties, have they been met with already, or are they still to be met with?
Mr. Chair and members, the council has reached out to them and offered to meet with them, and I believe there was a meeting recently with Carver County. If not, there's something in the works, but there has been that follow-up, offer from the council to visit with them individually to talk specifically about the issues in their areas.
Okay, thank you. Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Shetman, I'm just kind of looking between the 2014-2015 budget. Looks like about an $18-20 million increase in state revenues that you're expecting, about a 5% increase year over year. How much of that is increased subsidy to transit? And I'm also wondering, are there any exhibits or information that you could provide that would show the breakdown of that? So, for instance, if we're, as Mr. Lamb said, if we're reducing service to, through the buses and shifting that traffic to light rail, we'd expect to see some sort of net-net. And I'd like to see how that subsidy is being allocated.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pratt, those are good questions. What happens is that we receive 36% of the motor vehicle sales tax statutorily. 40% of it has to go to transit constitutionally. Mm-hmm. And so what we have in our budget is the MVEST that comes in. We don't have a specific dollar amount. They are forecasts, which we all, I think, are aware of what the state forecasts. We've got a smaller piece of that, of the MVEST forecast. And so what we see in there is an addition of MVEST, and we've got a regional allocation model that we use to distribute MVEST, but it goes it goes to Metro Transit Bus, all the opt-out providers, and Metropolitan Area Transit. And so part of that is return on MVEST that is a little bit ahead of forecast. And so I want to also say that many of you were here during the late 2000s where we were anticipating that MVEST was going to go gangbusters, and it went exactly the other way. And so we're actually finding a good medium here where we think MVEST is performing to forecast, and 1% of MVEST is worth around $6.5 to $7 million a year. So that little number that you're seeing is a tiny little improvement in MVEST over our yearly totals. And so what could happen is that it could go down or whatever. Could happen to it. We don't know what will happen with MVEST. It seems relatively strong right now. But you're seeing that number that you're talking about deals with the MVEST. The other thing is that in the budget, you're asking what would we do with it. In the last biennial budget, we had operations for Central Corridor included in there. But we only included 1 year's worth because the Central Corridor Green Line was only going to be operating for 1 year. Now, in this next biennial budget, we have to add that second year in there. So when you're asking how will we use this, yes, thank you, Mary. We do a calendar year budget. The state uses a fiscal year budget, which is confusing for me all the time. That is where we have to then make a decision about how do we use this. And I know I'm giving you a really long and winded answer here, but it's complicated. And so and because our numbers move from month to month. But to tell you specifically how we're going to do that, it's easier for me to do that when we bring forward our budget to the legislature, because then we're working off of solid general fund numbers and have the February forecasted numbers that the state is going to be budgeting off of. So that's a much easier way for me to show you exactly how we're going to fund our transit system with state funds. Does that make any sense?
Senator Pratt.
It does. I think, as I recall, in 2013 we had a fairly substantial request from the general fund, and as I recall, that wasn't related to MVEST. That was separate. And so what I hear you saying is a majority of the $20 million increase is coming from MVEST, and not necessarily a request for additional operating subsidy out of the general fund.
Mr. Chair, we assume our base appropriation when we put our budget together. So base appropriation plus the forecast, and we assume the forecast is correct for motor vehicle sales tax.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Pratt, when we look at the budgeting, there was an increase in the 2013 budget, but that was the state satisfying its statutory requirement to pay 50% of the cost for light rail, and that is in statute. And so they were underfunding a piece of the Hiawatha line, or the blue line, and then we had the new operations coming online for Central Corridor, the green line, and then that's where you saw that increase occur because it was fully funded by its statutorily requirement.
Mr. Pratt, another Senator Pratt, another follow-up.
So as we talked in 2013, there's a couple of sources for revenue, right? There's, you know, certainly some state appropriation, but also we talked about ridership and fare box collection, and fares haven't been adjusted since 2008. And even, you know, even your doc shows an annualized inflation rate over 10 years of somewhere between 2% and 3%. I guess at what point in time should we expect, right? And I know when I've asked this question in the past, you haven't been able to break it out by mode. You've just been able to talk about fare box collection in the aggregate. As you come forward to the committee process, I'd like to see that broken out and what we're paying for, because I suspect that our, you know, it's nice that the council has kept their levy below inflation, but certainly fares haven't kept up with inflation either over the last, I guess it'd be now 7 years.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Senator Shetland. Pratt, that is all part of our budget setting discussion right now, so I agree with you. I think that to be able to have that conversation during the committee process is appropriate, and we will be able to then show you at that time how fares are reflected from each of the different modes.
Representative Scott, question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is the current fare for the North Star now? I know this summer it went down by a buck or something. Is it back up? What's the going rate for a one-way ride?
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott Brian Lamb again, General Manager. Right now, the fare varies by distance. The longest distance, of course, is from Big Lake to Minneapolis, and that fare is, one-way fare is $6. Elk River is $4.50. Ramsey is $3.25. And then from Anoka, Coon Rapids, and Fridley, which are within our existing service area, are $3, which is commensurate to the express fare.
And so,
Representative,
thank you, Mr. Chair, if I might. On when you put down the subsidy per passenger on here, is that based on the longest distance ticket, or is it all figured in there aggregately?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative Scott, it is the average, so it's taking the total cost of the service and the total revenue that we were able to derive from all of those fare sets, and then that's what's divided into the total cost.
Thank you. And I do have a question on page H1, Mr. Chair, if I might. It's under the environmental services. From on the environmental quality assurance, last year, looks like there were 103 employees. This year, a significant drop to 36. Could somebody explain what that might be, why that happened?
I don't see. We'll go down here.
Need to phone a
Representative
friend?
Scott, Mr. Chair. I don't have an answer for you right at this moment. Is it okay for me to, I don't know if phone a friend will work at this point. Otherwise, otherwise, I can certainly get an answer for you, because that is a really good question, unless it's a typo. But I'm not sure what – yeah, it looks like we have an answer here. Thank you.
I would like to announce that if you have any questions for Ms. Bogie, that please ask them immediately, because she has another commitment that she must leave to.
Mr. Chair, my name is Lisa Thompson. I'm the General Manager for Environmental Services. And what you're seeing there is some reorganization that we've been doing as people are retiring. So you see an upswing in another area on the chart. So our total number isn't changing all that dramatically. It's just a matter of how we're organizing. One of the things we're trying to do is get rid of silos and integrate and work together. And thinking about the Thrive, how we need to work with communities and bring our integrated thinking about water and planning together. So we're positioning ourselves for some of the challenges in the future by taking advantage of retirements and making it less disruptive for staff to have to adjust to reporting changes and things of that sort.
Okay, thank you. And I do have one final question, Mr. Chair, and then I promise I'll shut up. And this one is for Ms. Bogie. I've read different reports regarding the lifespan of light rail, anywhere from 15 to 30 years. And so I'm wondering, are you planning ahead for the future for replacement? Is that in your reserve account? What's being done to plan ahead on that? Thank you.
Ms. Bogie.
We do a six-year capital improvement plan, and definitely we are making some plans for overhauls of whether it be a bus or whether it be a light rail train. There are maintenance things as well as overhaul-related things that we do on our systems. We just completed recently an overhaul of the rail trains on the Hiawatha line. So those are definitely part of the capital improvement plan. They're definitely a part of the funding that we see in our requests here.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Being that we've come to the end of our scheduled meeting.
Mr. Chair, I thought...
Representative Runbeck.
I had a question, not of Ms. Bogie.
Oh, okay. So I think all questions for Ms. Bogie have been asked. Thank you very much. Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Shetland, in terms of the... human resource components, I guess, of Met Council, do you employ actual engineers, and how many engineers, and civil, mechanical, whatever? I mean, I guess I'm kind of driving at, do we have science that is sort of forming, that helping form opinions and add ideas at the council, or not?
Mr. Chair and Representative Runbeck, yes, we do have engineers. We have engineers in our transportation areas.
Mm-hmm.
We've got the director of our MTS program is an engineer. Our project offices, many of you are familiar with Mark Furman, who is also an engineer. But we, in our wastewater and also in our water supply activities, we've got engineers who are really the scientists behind some of this information. I can't tell you off the top of my head how many engineers we have, but the council's work in some of these real technical areas is rooted in engineering and science, and that is why we employ those people to be able to assist us in these areas. But if you are looking for something specific, all you need to do is ask me, and I can find out for you.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Well, now that you've had the time to read over the minutes, I'll entertain a motion to approve the minutes of the last meeting.